Hi everyone and welcome back to Memcast. My name is Dr. Rachel Savile and I'll be your host today. We've got Dr. Richard Bowman with us, who's one of our acute medicine registrars here in the East Midlands. Welcome back, Rich.
Yeah, thanks. Great to be here again.
So we're going to continue on our three-part cardiology, stable angina, nice management. We've talked a little bit in the past about how we diagnose stable angina, what investigations we need to do. And today we're going to focus a bit more on the management side of things. Would you mind just recapping briefly what we've talked about in our first two episodes so we've got a starting base to go from for the management plan?
Yeah, so we started off just talking a little bit about NICE guidance in general and how it might be different to what you might be practicing locally for various reasons. But then we focused in on how to practically set up a healthcare system so that patients can present to someone, tell them they've got chest pain, and then the system knows what to do and where to send them. And then we drilled down a little bit on if you've said that these are not an emergency case, or if they are an emergency, how much of an emergency they are, thought about ACS and stuff, and then we were just left with someone who's having chest pain and we wanted to think about whether or not it was their heart. And then we went into diagnosing stable angina. So we're now moving on to a different guideline this week. So this is NICE clinical guideline 126, originally published in 2016. And this is specifically for stable angina. So there are sections on here that we'll repeat, but we'll probably not go over those again because they were covered by earlier sessions.
So we're just going to talk firstly about stable angina, and then we'll talk a bit more specifically about the management plan after.
Yeah, so as we've skirted around earlier in previous episodes, we'll just remind ourselves now exactly what angina is. So if you remember using that analogy of a fixed partial blockage in a blood vessel in your leg, imagine how that would make your leg feel when you used your leg and when you stopped using your leg. So a stable angina is a little bit like claudication of the heart. So NICE sort of recaps that and describes it a bit. So it's constricting pain or discomfort of the anterior chest, which might radiate to the neck, shoulders, jaw or arms, triggered by physical exertion, which will make the heart have to work a bit harder, or it can be triggered by emotional stress, which can also give you a tachycardia or things. The cause of angina, the cause of this clinical presentation, is, as we know, coronary artery disease. And a few facts and figures, so 8% of men and 3% of women between the ages of 55 and 65 will experience some episodes of angina. And this gets more common in age, as does coronary artery disease and its associated events like MIs. So 14% of men and 8% of women will experience angina between the age of 65 and 75. But just to remind ourselves that this is a chronic condition. So these are fixed narrowings of the coronary artery disease. It is slightly associated with an increased mortality risk, and that's possibly just to do with the fact that the things that cause fixed stenosis are also the things that cause unstable disease of coronary artery disease. In a similar way, the risk factors are shared between stable angina and ACS. So that's why it's kind of associated with a slightly higher mortality risk. And again, just to draw the distinction between stable angina and primary risk factor modification. So this is not what we're talking about here. So if you go to your GP surgery for your annual checkup and they do your height and your weight and your family history and your cholesterol levels, and they might say something like, oh, I think you should be on aspirin, or think something like that to reduce your chance of MIs in the future. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about people with a clear clinical syndrome with a diagnosis of stable angina, and we just want to know what to do with these people.
So where do we start?
Yeah, so I'll just talk briefly about our management strategies, and then we can go down into the details. So there are different things that we can do to make these people feel better and to take away their symptoms. Now, most of what we're doing is not going to make them live longer. It's really just to make them live more comfortably. There are different management strategies that the cardiologist might use. So there are some drugs that can make the symptoms go away, lifestyle modifications. And then occasionally we might do an invasive management technique, such as angioplasty with stenting or balloons, or maybe even a heart bypass surgery. But your symptoms would have to be quite bad and debilitating to warrant that. There's a very small caveat that we might favour angioplasty with stents or triple heart bypass in very particular situations, who, even if people aren't that disabled by their symptoms, and that would be triple vessel disease or a very, very significant single vessel left anterior descending vessel, because there probably is a little bit of mortality benefit from actually intervening. But most of what we're talking about here is just things that we can do to make people with stable angina feel better.
Okay, so let's go back to the start there then. So what things can we put in place to help prevent symptoms of stable angina?
Sure, so this is really just lifestyle modification and a couple of drugs. So we would sort of want to stop the condition getting worse. So your usual sort of cardiovascular risk factor modification, smoking cessation, exercise, things like that. But when you're starting to think about drugs, really the first drug you're going to reach for is a short-acting GTN spray. So a little bit like asthma, then you're going to give someone a salbutamol PRN inhaler. Well, your GTN is as a PRN device, short-acting. When you have your symptoms, you take that, they make you feel better, and then you get on with your daily life. So that's probably step one, if you like, of the treatment hierarchy. When you're prescribing a PRN GTN, which isn't always a spray, sometimes patients prefer fast dissolve tablets or things like that. And occasionally it can be used as a patch as well, which is also quick acting. But you need to explain what you're going to experience as the patient with that. So it's going to have some vasoactive effects, headaches, flushing, and they need to know how to use it. You know, if it is a sublingual spray, then they need to know how to do that themselves. And also you can sort of counsel them on how to use it preventatively. So if every time they mow the lawn and they get some angina, well, you know, it's okay to kind of take it just before you start mowing the lawn as well. But also the important thing to talk to them about is safety netting, because you don't want to give them false reassurance that actually, okay, their problem's fine now, I can ignore all forms of chest pain, because that's not true. So we need to educate them on what's stable angina and remind them they might still be at risk of an ACS syndrome in the future. So generally the advice that we give people is that they can give themselves two doses of a PRN GTN, but if it hasn't resolved, first dose 5 minutes, second dose 5 minutes. So we're now at 10 minutes of chest pain, they need to be ringing 999. So the other part that you need to consider when you've got someone with stable angina is just going back and remembering that they are in that other category of people as well, that they need attention to their risk factors. So we might want to consider some 75 milligram of daily aspirin on risk benefits. If they're diabetic, we might consider an ACE inhibitor, statin based on their risk and cholesterol levels. This is all dealt with in other areas of NICE guidance to do with primary prevention of coronary artery disease, and then also control of essential hypertension. You should do that as a kind of standard practice. So although we're not really addressing their stable angina, we're recognizing that these people, you know, will have an increased risk of coronary artery disease, and that shouldn't be ignored as part of our general thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so what treatments are available specifically for patients with stable angina?
Yeah, so we've tried that PRN GTN as kind of our first step symptom prevention. We're now on to people who are going to need a regular medication, again, for symptom prevention. And there's a few different drugs that we can use. It's quite helpful if you're prescribing these to remind the patient and make sure it's documented clearly in any letters of exactly why you're on these drugs. Because if they actually start experiencing side effects from these drugs, then it's useful for other doctors or clinicians who come into contact with the patient in the future just to be reminded that these are for symptom benefit. So if they're causing them side effects, well, then, you know, maybe it's time to review these. NICE says that if things aren't controlled by PRN GTN, then depending on your own discretion, you can either start one drug or start two drugs together, depending on, you know, how severe their symptoms are. And then up titrate to the response. And the aim is to reduce the episodes of angina and review the patient probably after every 2 to 4 weeks after a dose change or an introduction of a new medication. Let's assume that we're just starting one drug first. So the first line would be either a beta blocker or a calcium channel blocker. Again, starting as a lowish dose that's going to minimize the side effects and then up titrating as responded. And then you've kind of reviewed them every couple of weeks. And again, this could be in the GP surgery, doesn't have to be under specialist direction or something, if they've got a clear diagnosis and you're just managing their chronic disease. So you feel like you've maxed out on one of those drugs. The next step is actually to stop that drug and try the other one. So nice, because it's just symptom prevention, we don't want to just be adding in more and more drugs. So they actually say if you started with a beta blocker, you've up titrated it, they're still not happy, not getting enough benefit, well then let's stop that and let's try the calcium channel blocker, and we're going to up titrate that, or vice versa. And then third line, then you go to your two drugs. If you're going to combine a beta blocker and a calcium channel blocker, then as you probably already know, we always want to avoid certain types of calcium channel blockers because of the risk of AV node blockade. So when combining, we always use a slow-release dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. So that will be your nifedipine, your amlodipine, or your flodipine. Obviously, with monotherapy, with a calcium channel blocker, then you can use any type of calcium channel blocker. But if it's alongside a beta blocker, nifedipine, amlodipine, or flodipine. So now we're on kind of stage 3 or 4, aren't we? So we've tried our PRN-GTN, we've tried a beta blocker, we've tried a calcium channel blocker, we've tried both together. So now this is at the stage where we would consider revascularization interventions. So that would either be stenting, balloon therapy via the cath lab, or potentially even heart bypass surgery, depending on the anatomy. So that's probably the point where, if they're not already under secondary care, you need to be referring.
After you've considered revascularization therapy, we're kind of into specialist territory now, aren't we?
Yeah, so this is, I mean, obviously you'd be referring for that consideration. Not everyone's going to be suitable, but they need to be seen by a cardiologist at this point to decide whether it's suitable, and if they are, what kind, you know, whether it's a balloon therapy, stenting, or potentially even a bypass surgery. And then either that goes ahead and they're still symptomatic, or they aren't suitable for it, then again you've got these specialist options. They all have slightly different caveats to them that might be influenced by specific patient factors on why you might use one over the other. But in terms of specialist add-on drugs, we've got things like a long-acting nitrate, which, if you remember, if we're prescribing, it's we want to give a break overnight, so it's BD, and then you prescribe sort of morning and then early afternoon. Ivabradine, nicorandil, and ranolazine. Some of these are rate-limiting drugs as well. So the key thing here is that you should really only be on two drugs. So perhaps you didn't tolerate a beta blocker, and that then allows you to add on one of these other drugs, or you didn't tolerate the calcium channel blocker and allows you to add on the other drug. Perhaps you didn't tolerate either and you can add on two of these new drugs, but really you should really only be aiming for two drugs to control your symptoms. If you need to go to three drugs, then this is really only a bridge to intervention. And that again is quite a specialist decision, that so you shouldn't really be adding on a third drug. So potentially they saw the cardiologist, changed around with a couple of combinations, they've been discharged back to the GP on two drugs. If their symptoms come back or they get worse, then you need to refer back to the specialist, because triple therapy is kind of a specialist decision. And again, it needs that careful consideration about, really, do we need to go back and rethink, can we fix this problem with some stents? Do they need a bypass operation? Because the scales are kind of tipping a bit now and we're needing these extra drugs. You might see people on three drugs, but that might be because the cardiologist has decided, okay, I can't fix this with revascularization, or maybe they're on a waiting list for revascularization and they've just added in this third drug to kind of tide them over.
Brill, thanks. So we've talked there about the pharmacological interventions available for stable angina. What non-drug management options have we got?
Yeah, so this all gets a little bit technical and certainly something that I wouldn't be making decisions about as an acute medic. But it's useful to have a bit of an awareness on what isn't options if you meet these people who are waiting for these interventions. So broadly, we're talking about percutaneous intervention via the cath lab with a range of different options, stenting, balloon therapy, or coronary artery bypass grafting. Because this guideline is also aimed at specialist cardiology's audience, there is quite a long section on why you might favour some over the other. These probably need some careful workup with some specialist tests, possibly some functional imaging, or maybe even an angiogram where you're not going to do angioplasty. So it's really just to remember that this is really mainly just to make someone feel better. There are certain situations where you might get a slight mortality benefit. But really, if you delve into the case notes, a lot of these cases, sometimes the cardiologist will go to quite some length before they actually stent a lesion. They'll want to know how big is that lesion. They might even put a little pressure wire on either side of that lesion, and they might even then stress the heart to see how much that lesion is actually impacting oxygen delivery to that downstream muscle. They really want to sort of know for sure that they're going to make someone better by putting an intervention in before essentially committing them to dual antiplatelet therapy and all the risks that get associated for that. In broad terms, you might favour coronary artery bypass grafting if perhaps they also need a valve replacement. So really, these are all sort of quite specialist decisions. I think the key thing for non-specialists just to remember is that there are those very few cases where you might actually get a mortality benefit, and that's kind of triple vessel disease or very large left anterior descending lesions. So that's why we defer back to that. If it's not controlled on two drugs, well, we're probably in a complex case here. And then the final thing just to mention about stable angina is there is this new concept, and it goes by various names, but some people say it's cardiac syndrome X. And that's different to metabolic syndrome, but that's the terminology that NICE use. But you might know this as microvascular angina. So this is where you actually have done some imaging on the macrovessels of the coronary arteries. So the ones you learn about in the textbooks, right coronary, circumflex and all that. But they're actually still presenting with a angina syndrome. And then maybe you've done some fancy imaging and you can see that when stressed, that heart muscle does become a little bit ischemic. So the belief there is actually there is some problem with blood and oxygen getting to that muscle, but it's not actually viewable at the macro level and it's not explained by a single stenosis. And this might be more common in diabetics or anything else that might give you sort of little capillary disease. There is a small section on NICE on that, and really what they're saying is that this thing exists. We don't know a lot about it yet. More research needs to be done, but because we can't really categorize it in the same way as macro vessel disease causing angina, really only continue drug treatments if they actually are working for the patient, and if they're not working, then probably don't continue the drug treatments or maybe get a specialist opinion on it.
That's really helpful. Thanks, Rich. Thanks, everybody, for listening to us today. You'll catch us again next week on Memcast.